don't have enough time to sit down and read all the best Bitcoin articles? Well, let us read them for you. This is a Crypto Economy Quick Read. What is up, everybody? Welcome back to the show. Sorry about not having one out yesterday. We had a crazy snow ice storm combination over like 2 days, Sunday and yesterday, it kind of threw a lot of plans up in the air, and ended up the whole family stayed home and worked from home, so recording was really just not possible. Because of that, I focused on just trying to get updates to the website. So if you have not seen it, right now I've got a new layout that's a lot simpler. I felt like the website was getting really busy. And I'm trying to do a redesign on a completely new platform moving forward, but that's going to take a couple of months. So in the meantime, I've just got a much simpler and cleaner, at least I think so, website design up. So don't forget to check that out at cryptoeconomy.life. And for everybody who was following me on the Podbean platform, so sorry that I have switched to Anchor. I'm hoping that feed still updates properly and that anybody following me on Podbean will not have to go find me on a different platform. But if so, I will still be available on Overcast, Apple, hopefully all the other ones, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, all that stuff soon. I don't know exactly how long it takes to get approved on all those platforms. I'm still hoping, again, that Podbean just works with the redirect, but if not, I apologize. Just go to those other platforms to follow me there. But today's quick read is going to finally be A Skeptic's Guide to Bitcoin, Part 2 by Hasufly. And that's obviously the Medium post. If you've not listened to, what was it, last Friday's episode? Oh, no, that was the guy's take. It would be last Thursday's episode. The first part of A Honest Take on Fiat Currency. And this one is titled Unpacking Bitcoin's Social Contract. So without further ado, let's go ahead and jump right into this one, and we'll talk about it when we get to the end. Unpacking Bitcoin's Social Contract, A Skeptic's Guide to Bitcoin, Part 2. Bitcoin is a novel social and economic institution. It is so different from our existing institutions that we should be skeptical and ask as many hard-pressing questions as we can before trusting it with any economic value. Some answers will only reveal themselves with time, or Lindy, as the cool kids say. But that doesn't mean we can't come up with theories or frameworks. One such framework that has helped me a lot in understanding Bitcoin is social contract theory. First, fiat money is the result of a social contract. The people give the state control over the supply and other vital functions of money. The state, in turn, uses that power to manage the economy, redistribute wealth, and fight crime. But many don't realize that Bitcoin works through a social contract as well. And that social contract framework can be used to answer some essential questions. Why did Bitcoin come into existence? Who decided its properties, who controls it today, and can a critical bug kill Bitcoin? Social contract theory. Social contract theory starts with a thought experiment. It assumes a hypothetical state of nature full of violence that is unbearable for people to live in. Driven by a desire to improve their situation, they come together and collectively agree to empower Leviathan, the sovereign government, to protect them. Each gives up some of their freedom to, you know, steal and murder and stuff, while the Leviathan is granted the power to create laws, enforce them, and protect the people from violence. But the theory is not constrained to the relationship between the people and the state. we can apply the same thought experiment to economics. If enough people are unhappy with the barter economy, they can collectively agree to use money, credit, or something else to improve the quality of their trading. The process of money or credit happens implicitly. Every person asks the question of what outcomes they prefer and how they can achieve them. If many people in a society want the same outcome, we can call the result a shelling point or social contract. Money as a social contract. Throughout history, governments that controlled money have abused their power in all kinds of ways. They confiscated accounts, blocked certain people or groups from transacting, and printed more money and inflated the supply, sometimes to the point of hyperinflation. Whenever governments crossed a line in abusing their power, the people lost trust in the social contract that granted the government this power. They returned to an agreement that preserved most of the benefits, having a common medium of exchange, store of value, and unit of account, without the worst of problems, government abuse, a commodity money. The problem with the new commodity money contract, however, was that it turned out equally unstable. Let's take, for example, the gold standard. Physical gold was too inconvenient to divide, move, and store, so people quickly invented another layer on top of it and traded with representative paper money, while the physical gold no longer moved. Because paper money is easy to produce, there had to be a trusted central party to watch over the supply. From there, it was a small step for governments to decouple the value of the paper money from the underlying commodity to establish fiat money once again. Herein lies a valuable lesson. You can agree you're in a terrible situation and you can agree you want to change it, but the resulting social contract is only as strong as it is credible. Without a stable institution to enforce it, a contract loses the trust of the people and falls apart. The rules of Bitcoin. When Satoshi Nakamoto invented Bitcoin, he did not invent a new social contract. Satoshi did something else. He leveraged technology to solve many problems of past implementations and implemented the old contract in a new and better way. He settled on the following rules. 1. Only the owner of a coin can produce the signature to spend it. Confiscation resistance. 2. Anyone can transact and store value in Bitcoin without permission. Censorship resistance. 3. There will only be 21 million Bitcoins issued on a predictable schedule. Inflation resistance. And 4. All users should be able to verify the rules of Bitcoin. Counterfeit resistance. So, in short, the rules of Bitcoin are 1. No confiscations. 2. No censorship. 3. No inflation. And 4. Anyone can verify rules 1 through 3. Bitcoin as a new form of social institution. Money presents an important lesson. The larger and more valuable a social institution gets, the more it attracts others to seek control over it. So the institution needs protection, which it can only get from that other powerful entity, the state. Over time, protection turns into control and then into abuse. When the social institution loses its benefit for the people, it is replaced by a new institution, and the cycle starts over again. Satoshi attempted to break this vicious cycle in two ways. First, instead of getting its security from a powerful central party, like a government, Bitcoin creates a hyper-competitive market for its own protection. It turns security into a commodity, and the security providers, or miners, into toothless commodity producers. And second, Satoshi found a way for these competing security providers to come to consensus over who owns what at any given time. The Bitcoin protocol automates the contract agreed upon on the social layer, while the social layer determines the rules of Bitcoin based on the consensus of its users. They are symbiotic. Neither of them would be sufficient without the other. The social layer and its rules are the heart of Bitcoin, but the protocol layer makes them enforceable for the first time, while simultaneously making the social contract more credible to outsiders. Seeing Bitcoin as a social contract, enabled and automated by a technical layer, has many benefits, and it can help us answer the philosophical questions about Bitcoin. Who can change the rules of Bitcoin? The rules of the contract are decided and renegotiated continuously on the social layer. The Bitcoin protocol implementation only automates them. Bitcoin as a computer network comes into existence when many people run Bitcoin implementations on their computers that follow the same set of rules. Think of them as speaking the same language. You stay in the network as long as you follow the same set of rules as everyone else. If I were to change the rules of Bitcoin unilaterally on my computer, it would not affect the rest of the network. It only gets me evicted because we no longer understand each other. I now speak a different language. The only way to change the rules of Bitcoin is to propose a change to the social contract. Every such proposal has to be voluntarily accepted by other people in the network because it only becomes a rule if enough people actively include it in their local rule set. Convincing millions of people is an incredible amount of grassroots work and practically rules out any contentious changes, which could never get broad social consensus. This is why the Bitcoin network can be upgraded in ways that reflect the wishes of its members, but is at the same time incredibly resilient to changes from bad actors. Can a software bug kill Bitcoin? In September of 2018, a software bug arose in the most popular implementation or local rule set of Bitcoin. The bug had two potential attack vectors. It allowed an attacker to shut down other people's Bitcoin clients, making it so that they could no longer verify the rules, breaking the counterfeit resistance, and to potentially spend the same Bitcoin twice, breaking the rule of inflation resistance. Bitcoin developers quickly fixed the bug by providing the network with an updated rule set that closed these possible attack angles. While the bug was found in time and was never exploited by an attacker, it left some people asking, how much damage could it have done? Would the Bitcoin network have to live with the inflation once it happened, effectively breaking the trust in that rule? Social contract theory can answer that with a resounding no. Bitcoin's rules are made on the social layer, and the software only automates it. Where the social contract and the protocol layer diverge, the protocol layer is wrong, always. A failure of the protocol layer to temporarily enforce the rules of the contract has no permanent bearing on the validity of the contract itself. Instead, here is what would have happened. The potential bug exploit would have been mended by reorganizing the blockchain in a way that undoes the damage done by the attacker. This would have split the Bitcoin network into two networks, each having their own token, one with the bug and one without it. Every Bitcoin owner would have an equal number of tokens in each network. But the value of these tokens would be exclusively determined by the market, i.e., how much the next person was willing to pay for them. At this point, it's important to understand that the Bitcoin token itself has no value. It's nothing more than a number in a ledger. The value exists purely on the social layer. Hence, it is also social consensus that decides which of the two tokens going forward would receive economic support. It's likely that all economic value would migrate to the new, mended network. When the Bitcoin software successfully automates the rules of the social contract, the two layers are synchronized. And when the software temporarily goes out of sync, it always has the social contract as a guiding beacon of light to return to. This most recent bug will not have been the last. Social contract theory gives us assurance that bugs can happen and don't threaten the social institution of Bitcoin. Do Bitcoin forks endanger the no inflation rule? Another famous philosophical question centers around the concept of forks. Since Bitcoin software is open source, allowing users to verify that their rule set does what it says, anyone can copy it and make changes. That is called forking. But as established earlier, these changes are only made to the protocol layer, not the social layer. Without changing rules on the social layer first, the only result from forking Bitcoin is that you evict yourself from the network. If you wanted to fork Bitcoin and not have the new network die immediately, you would have to fork the social contract first. You would need to convince as many people as possible that your rule set is better for them, so they update their rules together with yours. These kinds of forks are scarce and hard to pull off because they require the buy-in of thousands of people. Using this process to create value is akin to running a presidential campaign as a financial investment. Again, the key is in understanding that all value for tokens is purely a social construct. The tokens do not have any value. They receive their value from social consensus. Forking the protocol doesn't equal forking the social contract, so the new token is worthless by default. In the rare case that the social contract itself splits, like when Bitcoin Cash split off from Bitcoin, you end up with two weaker social contracts, each agreed to by fewer people than the old one. Money in general, and Bitcoin in particular, can be seen as social contracts between people in society. Bitcoin is not a new contract either. It's just a new implementation of a contract that can be traced back hundreds of years. In comparison to previous attempts, the Bitcoin implementation is a dramatic improvement because it creates a hyper-competitive market for its own security. Bitcoin's social layer and the protocol layer are mutually reinforcing, and their relationship gives us insight into little understood concepts like rule changes, forks, or protocol bugs. All right, and that will close out part two of The Skeptic's Guide to Bitcoin by Hasufly. This one, honestly, when I read this, was really the one that got me really excited about this whole little series. I mean, I really enjoyed the first one, the honest account of fiat money. And we actually had a chat on Twitter about that, because specifically he talked about how, like, so many people in Bitcoin, myself being a great example, almost immediately assume or jump into the argument that Bitcoin is anti-government or it's competitive to government institutions. And that is not appealing whatsoever to a general audience. The vast majority of people think of their government as both a necessary institution and one that's a huge benefit to society. You have to have years of understanding and thinking and researching. Maybe, honestly, my route to thinking that government was actually a predominantly negative institution was based on this cycle that he talks about in this one, that it's impossible to set it up without it reaching basically an end of corruption and abuse. It's a system that has an inherent bug in it that has never been fixed. It's never been undone. It's just we keep restarting the system. We keep hitting the refresh button with the exact same bug in the system. So the nature of the system itself inevitably ends up breaking the social contract. And Satoshi's amazing invention was to actually automate the process of reaching consensus on that social contract so that it becomes a profitable, it created a profitable competitive market in staying in sync with the social contract and defending it with an energy cost, a provable energy cost at that, a proof of work. And the simplification, the defining of that social contract is honestly what I think was so great about this article. Because honest to God, I don't really care about anything other than those four rules. In complete truth, if we hard forked at some point because of some detrimental bug or because of some break in the, let's say, the encryption algorithm, let's say SHA-256 gets broken, or quantum computers change the very nature of the hash function. It becomes no longer a one-way function, or it is no longer a guess and check. You can actually reach the end without doing the full math, so to speak. Well, then whatever fork needs to happen and can reach social consensus on those four rules, I don't really care. Like, that is what's important to this whole thing. That is my social contract. That's why I think Bitcoin is such a powerful tool, because it can't be confiscated, it's censorship resistant, there's no inflation, and anyone can verify those rules. And I think that's the predominant issue. That was the major vulnerability or contention around the Bitcoin Cash and, you know, Bitcoin Satoshi's vision. Basically, the big blocker argument has literally been, and they lean on it in almost every conversation or debate that I have, is that number four isn't important, that everyone doesn't need to verify. And it's like, what's the point of having rule one through three if you're still just trusting that somebody else is doing it for you? So I don't agree. I think rule number four, anyone can verify the first three rules, is way more important than the first three rules themselves, at least whatever specifics they are. If you can't verify it, then the rules themselves are meaningless. So I think this article is a great addition to the long span of things that we have, the ever-growing collection of things we've read on the show, and that just out there in general, that really paints a picture of what Bitcoin is. Why does it have value? What kind of social consensus is this reaching? And in what way? How could something that's completely ethereal, that's completely quote-unquote virtual, have any value at all? And it is, in fact, the social construct. It's in the ability to... I love the analogy and have used it so many times of Bitcoin as a language. It's a monetary language. It's a language of value as opposed to a language of communication. Communicating value as opposed to communicating information. And I really like the context that he used that analogy in. I thought this was a great way to use the fact that as soon as you change the social contract, the rule set of your Bitcoin, you're speaking a different language. You're not hyperinflating the language. I've always thought that that's a great analogy to explain so many of those, honestly, rather silly, but not immediately intuitive on criticisms of Bitcoin, like the fact that because it's not a real thing that you can hold in your hand, that it doesn't have any value. It's like, well, what's the value of the internet? What's the value of the English language? You can't hold either of those in your hand. You can't hold software in your hand, but would you possibly say that they're valueless? Of course not. English is almost invaluable. Like, the very idea of language allows us to produce so much more efficiently and exchange information at such an incredible speed in comparison to not having it, that it practically holds the value of society. Like, you can't have a society without language. If you can't communicate information, whatever tool it is that you use, if you can't communicate, you certainly can't trade, you certainly can't build on somebody else's idea. You certainly can't expand and grow and progress technology. Like, all of that is derivative of the fact that we can exchange information at an incredibly fast pace, and I can basically grunt and make random noises into my microphone, and it paints a picture in your head of largely, at least we hope, roughly the same thing that I'm thinking in my head. Like, that's a rather insane idea when you really break it down to its points. Like, I'm not doing anything right now. Like, I'm just, like, none of these words are actually concretely meaningful. They're only meaningful because you have roughly the same understanding in your mind as to what I'm saying, as to what my grunts and sound modifications and humming and all the combination of all the nonsense noise that I'm making, that somehow by some bizarre miracle, it's creating the same mental patterns in your brain that are in mine. It's a fascinating translation of electrical signals in my brain for, as an interpretation of, you know, visual and auditory and sensing, feeling, and smelling information in my world, and the working out of patterns of reality that I am interpreting through all of those means of taking in information with electrical patterns in my brain, and then I'm turning it into basically an acoustic code that is being sent to you, and then you're attempting to recreate those same electrical patterns in your brain. And it doesn't obviously always work. I mean, I can say capitalism and it can make somebody go, ooh, yes, freedom and free markets. And it can make somebody else go, ooh, nasty, terrible people who make lots of money and blah, blah, blah. Like we don't always speak the same language. We don't always have the same meanings or the same patterns in our minds. So it's actually a really messy process. But it's almost inconceivable that it works on any level. It's insane. And money is that tool for value. It's that way to create an independent code of accumulating all of our general subjective value and tokenizing it and putting it into a language that can be exchanged so that I can hold on to, exchange at a later date, and prove ownership of a degree of value that I have either created or discovered in the past and hold it into the future. And that's a social consensus. It's a consensus that everything works massively better if we can reach consensus on that. Like, in the same way that it doesn't really matter what the Bitcoin token is called, it doesn't really matter what specific grunt or noise or movement of my mouth we use to mean five of a thing. I mean, obviously there are hundreds of languages and they all use a different grunt or noise, but they all mean five. What matters is that we have reached consensus on exactly what that grunt or noise is, so that I can say that I have five apples and you picture the same number of red fruit that I am picturing in my mind. The social contract around money is around a set of rules, very similar to how the social contract around a language is around a set of definitions. When you break those definitions, when you begin to mean something different, then you essentially evict yourself from being able to understand or communicate with the other people. In that same way, if you change your monetary rules in Bitcoin, you evict your ability to exchange and translate value with the other people who are sharing that rule set. And Satoshi's brilliant invention was in a mechanism to automate the rules so that we didn't have to constantly socially redefine what those rules are. We allowed the technology itself, we allowed a protocol to define the rules, and then we choose those rules. And a sound money protocol, a sound money social contract, is the most efficient, is the most productive, one that cannot be counterfeited, one that cannot be censored, one that cannot be confiscated, and where we can verify that all four of, or all three of those things are not happening, will produce the greatest wealth and be the greatest tool for measuring and exchanging value. Bitcoin is kind of like the dictionary of money, in the same way that you would, if everybody had the same exact dictionary of the English language and we were all somehow, by some miracle, using the exact same two down to the grain of understanding, we were using the exact same definitions of all of our words. Bitcoin is a protocol. It's the dictionary for making sure we're all using the exact same monetary standard. Another really cool piece of that analogy is that, you know, where a language or a word is taking a mental pattern and turning it into sound, and then sending it, you know, to other people, the proof of work function of Bitcoin is turning energy and real world cost into a digital signature that can be traded. A proof of work. It's just the whole thing. I've always loved that analogy, and I think this was a great application of it that does a really good job of clarifying a lot of the complications around the picture of Bitcoin, around understanding Bitcoin. So I really, really am excited about part three of this series, because this has always been something that has deeply fascinated me about the technology and about the concept of what Bitcoin is, because it's just, it really is just this novel thing. It's this whole other level of reaching a social contract around a monetary system. And it makes perfect sense why people would just be, would just fail to understand it. Like, why it would naturally be, lead to such skepticism and resistance. So despite the fact that I have not really used the argument, I've not really thought about it very deeply in that context, the idea of Bitcoin as a social contract is, I mean, he's absolutely right. It does a great job of making it clear some of the philosophical debates that happen around Bitcoin, around, you know, what does a fork mean? What does, what really gives Bitcoin its value? What are the core ideas that make Bitcoin, Bitcoin. So a thank you to Hasufly for this article. And please, if you enjoyed this episode, do not forget, I will have the link in the show notes. Do not forget to go check out the actual article on Medium, Unpacking Bitcoin's Social Contract, and drop some major applause for this work. And keep an ear out. Make sure you follow him both on Medium and Twitter. That's at, I think it's just H-A-S-U-L on, oh no, H-A-S-U-F-L on Twitter, and then add a Y to it on Medium. So definitely follow him and keep up to date on his work so you don't miss part three if you want to get a head start, and we will then cover it on the show shortly after it is released. One other thing to mention is there was a great article series that we read quite a while ago. It was towards the end of August, early September, I think, by Laurent MT, that was talking about the concept I mentioned of Bitcoin being a bridge between the physical and the digital, at least proof of work in itself. And then Bitcoin being a way to codify real-world costs and resources in the real world into the digital realm. And it's a really, really excellent series. Those are quick reads, 151, 152, 153, and 154. It's a four-part series by at Laurent, L-A-U-R-E-N-T-M-T, which he is that same tag on Twitter and Medium. So definitely check those out if you want to dive a little bit deeper into some of these concepts. And of course, Hasufly has a ton of stuff about trying to imagine or understand what Bitcoin is. He's a great resource for that, and that's why I'm always reading the next things that he's coming out with. So definitely check all of them out on Twitter and Medium. And of course, follow me on Twitter at The Crypto Economy. You can find all the other social media links at cryptoeconomy.life. Check out the new website. I got a simplified design in the meantime. And in a couple of months, hopefully sooner rather than later, probably around the beginning of 2019, we will have a completely redesigned and fresh website for all to see. And I have tons of stuff coming, so don't forget to check back regularly to the site and subscribe to the RSS feed if you want, you know, emails on all the updates that we have going on the site. And, you know, follow me on Twitter. I'll be posting it all there as well. All right, guys, thank you so much for listening, and I will catch you all back here tomorrow with another episode of the Crypto Economy Podcast. Take it easy, everybody.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.